Mini episode 561 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by TV Howl, your home on the web for coverage of today's television scene and a look at the history of the medium as covered by big-time TV critic Adam Buckman. Follow them on the web at tvhowl.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late-night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to part 2A of the Kyle Ross History of the Royal Rumble Spectacular that we're doing here. The second era is 1993 to 1997. Year 2A is 1993, of course. And Kyle, we're getting together to do this again. We talked about the first 5 years. Now we're in to do the second five.
You're laughing already.
I am, because I can't wait. 93 and 94.
You can't
especially.
Wait to talk about these years.
I know. I hate the product from these years, by and large, the way that it was presented. But sometimes it's the bad product is more
it
fun makes, to talk about.
It's like sports talk radio, right?
Kind
when
of.
The team is shitty, it's more
pretty
fun
much,
to bitch about it.
Pretty
right?
much,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's great to have you. By the way, I like the top billing, how this is my history through the Royal Rumble. As I force you to do I feel like
no,
I feel like I'm
no,
forcing
no.
you to go through these.
If
you don't want to do the Royal Rumbles.
I love them.
Are you sure you love them? Because it's funny. I have written
down
here.
I love these segments.
You know, if I could channel my inner Rudy Giuliani here.
Okay.
I'm not sure if you love the Royal Rumble, Rick Morris. Okay? Because
I don't love the match as much as you do, by and large.
No, you
I mean,
don't. No, you don't.
No, I don't. I mean, it's just a difference of opinion, but I love doing these segments. Look, it's the billing is you because this was your idea to do. You are the recognized expert. You are the guy with the SNS background. I'm just here to caddy for you, basically.
And you are the guy who wants your fantasy booking and the ECW arena mentality all over everything, isn't it?
I'm going to bring a lot of smark mentality to the proceedings,
yeah.
Kyle.
Okay.
The same way you would have once upon a time.
Yeah, until I, you know what I did? I got smart and got a job. Okay. I like these ham and eggers sitting in row triple Z at WrestleMania this year. I recommend they do the same. Put down the barista gig. Get a 9-to-5 like the rest of us.
Kyle Ross urging capitalism forward. Now I've seen everything.
Okay, well. So let's talk about what we have seen, by
yes.
the way, as I transition back to the
coming
point
off
at
the
hand.
Best year. Yeah.
Yeah. So in our first part, you know, we're shuffling these into parts A, B, C, D, and E, but you know, the way I conceive it is, you know, it's a 1, 2, 3, 4, like a 6-part thing.
Absolutely.
So in our first part, we covered the years 1988 to 1992. We called the birth to the, or the beginning to the best.
Yes.
And, you know, the beginning is self-explanatory. The best being 92, which is universally recognized as the best Rumble. It had tremendous star power. It had Ric Flair winning. We went through all of that. It's generally agreed on. It's one of 8 matches in WWE history I've given 5 stars to.
Okay.
Little house cleaning I want to get over to. I went up and looked at total buys of these shows
mm-hmm.
since the last time we talked. 91 did shockingly good business.
Really?
For the time period. It did like 450,000 buys, which was significantly above 90 and 92. Just wanted to point that out.
Okay.
90, I'm going to give the official star rating at 3.5.
All right.
Which I know is significantly higher than you.
And very much higher, yeah.
And I think that my bar overall bar is higher than you for these Rumbles.
Yes, it is.
I don't have a lot. I would say 80% of these are going to fall between 2 stars and 3.75.
Okay.
There's very few that are going to go below 2 or above or 4 and above. There's
okay.
very few. But now we enter what I'm calling the down period. That's part 2. Very uncreative name.
Okay.
But, you know, that's generally what it's recognized these years. 1993 to 1997. You referenced it.
Yep.
And I think the down period for the company as a whole and the down period for the Royal Rumble,
mm-hmm.
which this is, go hand in hand. Because
yep.
there's no match that speaks to the overall talent level of the roster than the
right.
Royal Rumble. Because you basically have to put almost everyone in there. And you're going to see a lot of things in this period that just are pretty eye-opening. I mean, there's a lot of, like, guys being brought in from outside promotions with no meaning.
Yeah.
No build, and really no point. We're talking about the period that business-wise did the worst.
Right.
And we start in 93. Let's get into it.
Okay.
First of all, I wanted to say one more thing before we get into these individually. Even after 92 being the best Rumble, I still don't think there's any inclination, if you're being objective and fair about this, that the Rumble would become the number two pay-per-view in the company.
No.
And it was not in 92. It still was behind SummerSlam.
Sure.
It was probably above Survivor Series. Survivor Series.
Probably.
Survivor Series pretty quickly became the number four. But
right.
There was not that indication yet that it would become the number two pay-per-view in the company. And I'll be honest, we're still a while away from that, from really coming to fruition.
Well, let me make a point before we get into 93, or actually two points. One is, and I kept repeating this through part one, I'm going to keep repeating this. If you want to hear our comprehensive thoughts on how this got set up, history, background, go to 1A for 1988, because we did it all there. We laid it all out in the beginning. So for people who are just jumping into this now, we're not going to do that every time. But we did it once. Go check it out on our 1988 1A.
Yeah,
so there's that.
Our good friend Shad Repek said he was unaware of the one-man gang's non-televised Rumble win, so we educated
He was
somebody.
Unaware. Okay, Bob Sacramento was unaware of that. All right, good to be able to tell. The other thing I want to say, too, is about your point on that. These years as a whole, I sort of, and the interesting thing is to draw a direct parallel to the teenage years of Kyle Ross, which coincided here, these mm-hmm. are sort of the teenage years, the formative years of the Rumble. They coincided in 93 with the beginning of Raw, in 96 with the beginning of the February pay-per-view, etc. By 1998, the Royal Rumble, I think, was more or less a fully formed adult as we know it today. These are the years where I think all the other touches kind of got put on it. These are the puberty years of the Rumble, if you will.
And as bad as the business is during this period, mm-hmm. I think there are some of those elements that, okay, maybe they didn't shoot anything through the roof, they didn't make a world of difference at the time,
right?
But there is some fun, I think, in kind of seeing, oh, this is kind of when they figured out that worked.
Yes.
Because you're right, the Rumble, by and large, has kind of gone unchanged. As we do this podcast in 2015,
yeah,
you kind of know what the match is at this
exactly.
point. There hasn't been any, it's been a long time since there was some sort of new booking way that this thing was booked.
Yes.
And let's go to 93.
Yes.
Because in 93, I think there's a very important development. That development being the winner of the Rumble getting the world title match at WrestleMania.
Very important.
First time it was guaranteed. In 91, yeah. It was obvious that Hogan was going to win the Rumble and go on to challenge Slaughter, but it was not officially a stip in the match.
Right.
92, the Rumble was for the title. So this is the first time.
And in 90, the champ won it and was in the main event anyways against the guy that he eliminated, Ultimate Warrior, so it was key to an angle. But you're right, 93 was the first time it was official.
Yeah, and 89 was just, they were just kind of getting
it. It was whatever.
89 was it's every man for himself, and we're just going to have a random guy win. All right, so why was 90, I guess, as we modernize here through the years, fans now, particularly now in this, 22 years after 1993, matches need to be for something. The idea of like the Rumble, actually it's funny, I'm glad you kind of did that brief history lesson. With 89, with it just being your 30 favorite superstars and every man's for himself, that didn't cut the mustard anymore.
Right.
It's kind of like, why Survivor Series died the way it did so quickly is because, it's tradition that a bunch of guys team up and they wrestle. Well, what's this for? What's the hook?
I think feuds have always been key to Survivor Series.
Yeah,
you're mashing up feuds, so it's not so much that my team won and that's part of my Hall of Fame resume. I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
Royal Rumble, it needed something more than being able to say for the rest of your career you won the Royal Rumble.
So why did they choose 93? I don't know. It was just the direction it was going in. But let's set the stage for some of these folks who weren't around in 93 or, just to be comprehensive like we always are with 93. This is a very bizarre time period for the company. They hadn't quite hit rock bottom yet, but the signs were all there.
Right.
What makes this specific time period so unique is that Hogan had been gone for a while, mm-hmm. but he was coming back
right.
for WrestleMania, and I'm assuming by this point they knew that.
They clearly knew that, but he wasn't referenced on the show because they hadn't done the Brutus Beefcake angle
yeah,
on Monday
and
Night Raw yet.
I'm trying to remember when that was. I think it was
like
early February, I think. It was a couple weeks after this.
Yeah.
So you had that, and in addition to Hogan, you still did have some holdovers from the, you know, the previous year or even the glory period, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they were being phased out, which
right.
is an issue. Savage was being phased into the commentary role.
Right.
Flair was being phased out of the promotion.
Yes.
Warrior had come back and left already in 92.
Right.
And the big thing is that Vince inexplicably went to Bret Hart as world champion.
Right.
And Bret was being promoted in a much different fashion than Hogan was as champion. He was the, you know, he was the fightingest champion of all time, is what they kept saying.
Right.
You know, they were trying to say, oh, you know, you'll see Bret Hart more. Look, and Bret was never going to be the champion Hogan was ever. It was just a different way.
Right.
It wasn't as effective, but it was probably the right way to promote Bret.
Well, here's the thing, too, and I had said that this off-air is something I wanted to get to, and I'll jump to it now. They said this in 95 at the Rumble when Bret was in the title match against Diesel. The most decorated champion in WWF history, because he'd been Intercontinental, he'd been tag team champion, whatever. To a generation raised on Hulk Hogan, you're seeing this non-steroided guy who'd been in the mid-card Hogan's whole time there, and he's now the most decorated champion in history. There was a disconnect with what the audience could believe about Bret Hart.
See, you hyped that up. Here, let me throw it back. You hyped that up too much. I don't think that's... I mean, you have to promote the guy somehow, and he had won...
But that's why they desperately needed Bret Hart to beat Hulk Hogan in 93.
They did, and that
was the missing piece of the New Attitude Era. They needed that job from Hogan that he never did.
All right, so it would have helped, obviously.
Clearly,
so
yeah.
Let's go back here. So Bret wins the title in late 92.
Yep.
And it was shocking, and in terms of the big match that you'd been accustomed to during the Hogan years,
yep.
it just wasn't there.
Right.
Like, Survivor Series 92, look, I love Bret and Shawn.
Sure.
It was their first time main eventing against each other in Survivor Series 92. It was a far cry from the peak main events of the Hogan era, although in ring it was much better. It was different. It did not do the business, but they went in a direction, and, you know,
champion versus champion, and yet it was presented as mid-card. I think we were both shocked that it went on last. I was there also.
Yes.
It was a shock it went on last.
Oh, yeah, because, yeah, the tag match had been promoted
yeah.
more, though, with, you know, Perfect and Ramon, or pardon me, Flair and Ramon against Perfect and Savage.
Yep.
But, all right, so let's talk about the main event picture.
Okay.
You could tell things were going downhill here.
Yep.
And the world title match, so, again, we have world title matches now, that's also true.
Right.
Not only do you have the Rumble for the shot to go to WrestleMania,
yep.
you're always going to have a title shot.
91
started
that, and it was instituted.
Yeah, so
yeah.
Now it's instituted. So the world title match here is Bret Hart, Razor Ramon, which I remember at the time, that coming across is so underwhelming.
Yeah.
I was convinced Razor Ramon was going to win because I'm like, why else would he be getting a title shot?
Use it to make him? Okay.
Yeah, and I was wrong in retrospect. I mean, he was way too green at that point.
Right.
Well,
he'd had a good run through the territories in the 80s. I mean, he had some spots where he was not around because of the drug issues.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he wasn't a green guy per se.
So, this is where I'm going to open up Pandora's box.
Okay.
And sort of let you go in the direction you want to take this.
Okay.
I will probably openly mock you, not only during part two, but
okay.
throughout all parts of this for
right.
fantasy booking
okay.
alert. But I'll do a little bit here on my own.
Okay.
So, going into this show, it was very obvious that Yokozuna was probably going to win the Royal Rumble. They had
yes.
high hopes for him, right?
Yeah.
And I think that the inevitability of him winning mixed, and we'll touch on this
mm-hmm.
when we talk about the actual Rumble match, whenever you choose to do that, is what makes this Rumble, in my opinion, one of the worst, with the lack of drama and the inevitability going in. It just makes it boring. But here's the thing. If they were so high in Yokozuna, you always read, oh, they're real high on this Yokozuna. If you go
mm-hmm.
back and read what was being written at the time, oh, we're so high on Yokozuna. Here's my question. If you're so high on him, why were you going to have him be champion for 30 seconds?
Good question.
Because, as we all know, you referenced it a moment ago.
Yeah.
The plan was for 93, Brett, you know, Hogan comes back and wins the title in impromptu fashion at WrestleMania 9,
right,
which he did.
Yeah.
Then plans go awry. They were going to rehab Brett by having him – they instituted the King of the Ring pay-per-view.
Right.
And they were going to have Brett go over there, Hogan beat Yoko, and then Brett beat Hogan, win the title back at SummerSlam, the old pass the torch situation.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that part never happened.
Right.
Here's my thing, and this is more of a WrestleMania 9 qualm than I guess it is Royal Rumble.
Okay.
But if the goal is to put over Brett as the champion,
mm-hmm.
this whole thing was screwed up from the start.
Rather than
risk it, because did they really think Hogan was, oh, you know, sure, I'll put over this Bret Hart. Did they really think that was going to happen? What they should have done, here's a little fantasy booking from me,
mm-hmm.
and if they were so high on Yokozuna,
mm-hmm.
what do we know? Here's what we know. With fantasy booking, you have to just accept things.
Yeah.
Business was in the toilet in the summer of 92, although SummerSlam did huge because they had really tapped into the European market. It was a smart move to go over Wembley for that show to give the illusion that things were still going well. But
yeah.
Generally speaking, Randy Savage's second world title reign is terrible.
Right.
It did not do good
at all. Dwight
well
and West.
The box office.
Yeah.
Rather than all this chicanery with Flair winning it back and then quickly jobbing it to Brett, why didn't they just have the monster Yokozuna, who was imposing from the beginning, just come in and beat Randy Savage? And he then be the champion you build around. And have Brett, you build Brett up rather than just try to shoot to the moon thing, which didn't work.
Yeah.
I think Brett would agree that his first title reign did not really work. People weren't ready to buy it yet. It's
right.
One of those things that, like, the promotion was ahead of the fans.
He admits that himself. Yeah.
So why not, instead of having – I thought the dynamic with Brett as champion and Yokozuna as this dominant challenger was so screwed up. Because Brett wasn't an established champion like Hogan was when he met Andre. And remember, during Hogan's thing, to make these Hogan-Brett comparisons keep going with him, Hogan always beat the giant heel.
Right.
This whole situation did Brett no favors.
Right.
So to me, the whole dynamic was screwed up. Yokozuna should have come in, won the title right away. Brett's the guy then you build up, and he wins the 93 Rumble, goes to WrestleMania, wins the title, and if you could convince Hogan to do the match with Brett where he challenges champion Brett to put him over, then you do it, but you're not screwing yourself.
This is one of the things I love about this anthology, because you just said something I never thought of, and probably nobody else out there listening to this ever thought of, because I think we all tend to think, what would you have done in October of 92 when Flair got hurt, they needed to get the belt off of him, whatever. You're looking at it, what would you do coming off of SummerSlam? Because it's key that Yokozuna beat Savage. It wouldn't have worked on Flair because it's heel versus heel. That's a great thought there. That's an absolutely great thought on your part.
I thought of that one. You know,
yeah.
You know, 20,
yeah.
20, well, 23 years later, I came up with something.
Well, here's a funny thing, too. I was thinking about this as well, and reflecting on this is one of the strangest things ever. For a guy to win the Royal Rumble and get that big push right off the bat, because, again, you and I were at separately. We didn't know each other at the time. Survivor Series 92. I think he wrestled.
I was busy campaigning for Clinton, by the way.
I was not. I was sitting that one out with read my lips running on the other side. But Virgil. I'll tell you that for him to wrestle.
Who did Virgil vote for?
I think we know.
Okay, you ought to be ashamed of yourself.
I'm gonna give the Bobby Heenan type thing here. He was the one who wrestled Yokozuna. Yokozuna.
And he wanted to tell all of his friends, man, this guy's for real. That was a really bad promo.
That was. Yokozuna, I can't ever remember somebody coming in and getting the WrestleMania push without a single feud under their belt. That was not a feud, that was a match.
And I can't remember exactly.
It's so weird.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly. He was really new. He may not
right.
have been available, but, like, would it have been a big deal if he would have just won the title in his first match? If they just showed
right.
Yokozuna, look at this guy. And he was imposing.
Well, maybe they could have petitioned for footage of him as Coquina Maximus taking out Greg Gagne in 89.
Or, you know, he literally could have just come in and won his first match. But anyway, that didn't happen.
Right.
And so we get this show.
Right.
And what's interesting about this show is you've still got the holdovers.
Right.
You've got from calling back to the glory days, I guess. But they were all a little long in the tooth.
But that's why I like this better than the later ones. You still had, in my mind, some residual star power on this card that you didn't have later on.
Yeah. And you also have some key members of the quote unquote new generation, which
yes.
you know we'll mock for the next couple hours here or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Put in key positions: Brett, Sean, and Razor.
Yep.
The two singles champions going into the show are Brett and Sean.
Yep.
And you know, from a match perspective, that helps. I mean, although the IC title had been the workers' title for years, Sean
right.
wasn't the first great worker to have the IC title. I mean, hell,
right.
Brett had it.
Right.
You know, shortly before him. So, where, and oh, by the way, I should mention this, too. You talk about Blast from, you know, kind of that bridge to the past era.
Yeah.
Last pay-per-view that Monsoon and Heenan do together.
Yes, yes. And that's another thing that I like, because the rest of the Royal Rumbles if from there that we're going to be talking about today, you have Vince paired up with various combinations of Flotsam and Jetsam. By 97, at least, it's Vince, JR, and the King. 94, 95, 96 sucked balls.
Yeah.
93, with Heenan and Monsoon, that's another reason I favor it.
Although it's funny, let me get this straight. The show
mm-hmm.
as a whole, 93,
yeah.
I think compares favorably to some of the other ones we're talking about here. The Rumble itself, I don't think it does, and I know that's a bone of contention that we're going to have
okay.
here momentarily. It's funny. I actually watched the Rumble first before.
Mm-hmm.
I watched the undercard in this. It was weird. Before I even had told you
okay.
about this, that I wanted to do this, I started watching random Rumbles.
Okay.
And I was like, hey, Ricky, you want to like do an anthology? And so I was like, oh, crap. Well, I got to go back and watch the other stuff now. So this is one of the pay-per-views I had to do that with.
Okay.
And it was funny. I had actually written down in my notes for the Rumble match itself for 93.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that a little bit of that magic had gone out of the bottle with Monsoon and Heenan. But I'll say this. I went back and watched the other matches, and
yeah.
they were great.
Yeah.
Like I thought they were really pretty. Heenan was his usual funny self in the two title matches here.
They were.
But
I thought.
Maybe, you know, I thought the Rumble itself was pretty boring, which maybe led to them not being that interested. But where do we want to go here? Do we want to talk about the two title matches?
I love
or do we want to talk about the Rumble itself?
I love how we handle the formatting on air here. You want to just go with the undercard? You just want to take it from the top? Or what do you think?
Let's do that because I think we're going to agree more on the title matches.
Okay.
It's a less interesting talking point.
And then there's some things, you know, we can gloss over aside from the title matches.
Mm-hmm.
First up, the debut on pay-per-view. I think they'd been on TV previously. The Steiners.
Oh, you want to talk about this?
As far as the undercard goes, Steiners, Beverly's. It was a debut showcase for the Steiners. I thought it was pretty good in that regard. I'm not a guy who was really able to sit through that many Beverly Brother matches. Give me the Demolition Crew any day. As far as the presentation of those guys. But I thought it basically worked. It's not the Steiners' best match.
It served its purpose. This was not supposed to be a great match. It was supposed to
right.
establish the Steiners to the WWE audience.
Well, you know,
and
they gave the Beverlys a lot. It wasn't maybe the squash I would have liked to have seen, but, you know, whatever. It worked.
That's true. But, I mean, again, you know, you're working with a three-hour pay-per-view and you have,
yeah.
like, five matches. So you have to, you know, these tag matches back
yeah.
You know, this was kind of the last one,
right.
actually, where they did that, where they had a tag match kind of open, and they gave it a lot of time just because they didn't have a lot of matches.
Yeah, the Orient Express used to be in the faux work rate showcase
yeah.
slot at
now,
the top.
Yeah, now it was the Beverly's. I'll say this. See, I always look at things at a macro level, and rather than, you know, I have nothing really to add with the Steiners. It was the way to do things.
Yeah.
I look at things at a macro level. The Steiners, and I want to tie it in. This is where I'm going to take it here.
Okay.
I'm not going to let you OCD Rick Morris just go bullet point by bullet point. I'm just going to start throwing things around.
All right.
What's it? This is something we haven't even mentioned yet.
Okay.
Let's get it out there now. The Steiners were not the only former WCW stars making their debut on the show. You had Lex Luger
yes.
as the Narcissist, which bombed, I might add.
A
and
goofy
also,
segment, but Heenan made it.
Well, except for the fact that he kept mispronouncing Narcissist the entire show. He kept saying Narcissist, and it really it's funny. I always make fun of you and, you know,
mm-hmm.
bat my lashes at you for picking out these bizarre things.
Yeah.
It really irritated me the whole show. He kept saying Narcissist.
But no. I don't think it was that. And here's the thing, too. I think because they also did the whole Caesar Cleopatra thing for WrestleMania 9. Remember when they came out and they read the Royal Proclamation? It will be at Caesar's Palace.
That was a horrible use of five minutes of pay-per-view time, by the way.
I kind of laughed. It was kind of funny. But here's the thing. He wasn't saying Narcissus. It was Narcissus, like the Greek god thing. I think they didn't exactly know if it was going to be Narcissus or the Narcissist.
Oh, I apologize then.
So Heenan was kind of he was invoking the whole thing here. I don't know if that was supposed to tie into Caesar. I don't know why it would, because...
I think he was still mispronouncing it, though.
I think it was Narcissus rather than Narcissist.
Okay.
We could be...
Okay.
I don't know who's right about that.
All right, maybe that's... Okay.
But that was...
Okay.
Aside from that, what did you think of the segment? I mean, I laughed. I was not supposed to be
what,
pure...
What, the Luger?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was terrible.
But, I mean, weren't you laughing at the way Heenan was just so over the top?
Yeah, it was all right, and it was fun. I mean, it was Luger, and I remember at the time, I was like, oh, Lex, finally. Like, what had they been doing? And it's funny, he had actually made his on-screen debut with WWF at WrestleMania 8, like 8 months before, but he had to be held out because of his...
It was WBF.
Yeah,
stuff.
Well, he was put in the WBF solely because of his WCW contract. He had no compete, and he couldn't wrestle for WWF right away.
That was a hell of a loophole.
It was, and yeah, the WBF was a hell of a hole.
True.
But
go buy IcoPro, kids.
Yeah, here's my thing. So Steiners and Luger, here's a verdict on that. I think it was a very, I have written here, two key debuts, question mark. I am Ron Burgundy.
Okay.
So with they got good pushes coming over. As former WCW guys who are big names, and it's funny, I know you've had some bones to pick through the years, and some more valid than others, about them not recognizing, them being WWE, not recognizing outside history.
Right.
But in some cases with Flair and these guys here, Steiners and Luger, there really was no pretending that these guys did. You know, they even kind of in their own way were like, all right, a lot of people kind of know who these guys
Wink
are.
Wink and a nod. And they did that with the Road Warriors, too.
Yeah, Road Warriors. Yeah. You know, and then Arn and Tully maybe a little bit, too.
Maybe.
Not as much. But I bring that up because, you know, overall with Steiners and Luger, here's the final verdict. They got the standard, they were a star in WCW push. And it worked. It may not have worked as much as they'd hoped in either instance. And then it kind of fizzled and they went back to Turner. But, you know, I just think it's interesting that you brought in, you know, these key players from, you know, Flair was leaving, and we'll get to that because I think that's a big component of the show. You know, Flair was leaving, but you're bringing in other guys from the competition.
Right.
And, you know, you're putting them in high-profile spots. I mentioned to you, as we were talking about this before we turned the mics on, it shocked me how long it took them to put the titles on the Steiners.
Yeah, and again, you'd expect me to be critical of it, but I really didn't have a problem with it. They had the titles by June. That's the most you could. I mean,
they had to keep them on Money Inc. for the WrestleMania program with Hogan and Beefcake.
Here's the thing, too. I'm going by the standards of the previous era. 6 months is the ultimate rocket push based on how they've done it. How long had the Bulldogs waited for the titles or the Hart Foundation?
That is
true. I mean?
I guess that is true. I need to put that in perspective.
The scene, it was a cleared out wasteland of a tag scene.
Oh, yeah, and that's what makes it. I think it's just like you're so conditioned now.
Yeah.
Like if the Steiners, and again, there's not a team you could bring in like the Steiners today.
Right.
In 2015, there's just not. I mean, okay, the Briscoe brothers are a fine team. They're not the freaking Steiners.
How about the Young Bucks? Really? Okay.
No.
All right.
There are the portion of the audience that you like to make fun of, the non-smarky portion, has no idea who the Young Bucks are. And you
really?
Can make fun of them for that, but more people knew who the Steiners were than would know
That's
who the Young
true.
Bucks are.
That's true, yes.
So what I'm saying is, but like, even if here's the thing, even if the Young Bucks did come in today, they'd get the titles in like, you know, half that time. Well, maybe, I don't know. But here's what I'm saying, if the Steiners came in today, you'd expect that they'd win the title like 3 weeks later, you know?
Yeah, you're right.
But
you're right.
Given the time period, I guess it was quick enough. So Steiners and Luger, I just thought that was notable that you do have, despite you're entering this down period and there's kind of a question of star power, you know, they're big names that got brought in from the competition.
Well,
and they were key players throughout 1993.
Here's the thing, too. The other match to get to before we get to the two title matches, there is one match, for as much as I have criticisms of this era, of the new crop of guys not getting established by the old crop of guys, you did have a classic revolving door match here, and it worked.
Yes.
Bigelow and the Boss Man.
Mm-hmm.
Boss Man was heading for WCW later in the year. Bigelow was coming in.
And he was the boss. Man, is he big.
I'll tell you what, and this is a thing, too. Classic thing, and God rest their souls, neither one of them with us anymore, unfortunately. Big guys who could go, but, boy, no chemistry with each other. I thought it was subpar, man.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, do you expect? I mean, back in the, it's funny.
I expected more from them, frankly.
You expect? I mean, we talked about this, I think. When did we talk about that? We talked about this with Steamboat in 88,
yeah.
Even though you kind of pointed out maybe he didn't know he was leaving yet.
Right.
Guys out the door back then, just they phoned in from long distance. I mean, if Boss Man was basically there to put over Bam Bam Bigelow.
And he went over clean, and they didn't even remark on how unusual that was.
It was unusual
in 93.
It was a pretty big burial jump, yeah. But I have written down here, this is a classic case of the guy who's coming in beating the guy leaving. And
it was the right move.
Oh, it's
it
absolutely the right move. I mean,
they needed more of that kind of stuff.
The fact that the match itself wasn't, you know, didn't bring the snowflakes is irrelevant here.
Right.
And it's funny that Bigelow, it kind of took a while for him to get going, and obviously it doesn't end well for him in WWE. But you know, it's fine. I have no issue with that. It served its purpose.
Well, in terms of the two title matches, I will tell you this: the Michaels Jannetty match for the Intercontinental title, which again,
I'm interested to hear your take on.
More
this.
Start and stops leading up to this match, I tell you, because of Marty Jannetty's issues the previous year with the company and whatever. I'm going to tell you that, and I've said this a lot of times, I've said this about matches that you have fawned over, that I watched them and was just like, wow, given the baseline of expectations, I was underwhelmed. Savage Steamboat, when I went back and watched that, is a classic example. This is one where, this is the match that got Marty Jannetty fired, because, like, he was supposedly all drugged up and whatever, and the worst match ever, it got him fired. I watched it. No expectations. And I'm going, God, this is pretty good. What was so bad about this match? It wasn't five stars.
See,
but
I'm very interested. So
I didn't think it was that bad. So I thought it was about what you would have expected from Michaels and Jannetty, who were great workers.
So I've got this at 3 3/4. I like this match.
Yeah. Why does everybody crap on this match? Why
did
they get Marty Jannetty fired?
I don't think they do. Our good friend.
The conventional wisdom it was.
Our good friend Dave Meltzer gave it 4 stars.
He gave it 4 stars?
Yes, and he, you know, Dave calls me all the time for my star ratings.
Okay.
Here's the thing. So, I remember, I've
kind of got fired because it wasn't 5 stars. Okay.
No.
Right.
Well, here's the thing. They had, first of all, I like every Michaels Jannetty match.
Yeah.
I'm going to reference even, you know, they'll even, as we get leaner and leaner in the years, they'll mix it up in later Rumbles, and I always just love those brief spots, even if they're for 30 seconds.
Right.
They had better matches later in the year. This year in 93, yeah. The one on Raw comes to mind. And then they had an even better one, I believe it was also on Raw after that. That wasn't when Michaels was the champion and defending, and he retains. He has Diesel at that point in his corner. More on him in a little bit, his program, folks. But, so, I was very interested to see where you were going to come down on this.
Yeah.
Because, and I love you and these expectations. Can we go off on a tangent with expectations?
Expectations.
I am so sick of people and their expectations about anything. I'm going to talk about
them. But we're all prejudiced by what we hear.
I'm not.
Really?
I'm proud. I'm damn proud of myself. Like, when I read something, I remember when I used to. So I met, like, with Midnight Express Southern Boys, for instance. You brought that up, I think, on the last time.
I thought that was really, really good, but I didn't think it was all-time great.
Okay,
I just didn't.
See, it's funny. I had read multiple people
mm-hmm.
who had hyped it as all-time great, and I had never mm-hmm. seen it. And I went out, and I found myself a copy of it. Do you know where I found a copy of it? Dubbed it, by the way.
Where?
I love this. Athens Video.
Nice!
They had, I guarantee they don't have any more, because who the hell is VHS's? But in 1999...
Look behind you. Other side.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Right next to the Sega Genesis, too. And the Pat Buchanan books, too. Wow, okay. It keeps getting scarier and scarier.
I'm a unique bird.
Okay. So, by the way, there was 2 Athens videos.
Okay.
Down at OU.
Was
it
State Street?
East State, and there was one on Richland, actually.
Richland, okay.
By a gas station. I don't know if that was. So this is at OU, Ohio University, our alma mater, for those of you paying, not keeping score at home. Those two combined had the greatest collection of, like, 1990 to 1992 WCW VHSs I've ever seen. Like, the video store that I grew up by, like, had none of that.
Okay.
So I didn't really watch a ton of WCW at that time, so I didn't. So, like you, I didn't see Midnight Express Southern Boys at the time.
Right.
I have a point here. Work with me. So okay. I remember that matchup and hype that I watched, and I loved it, every bit of it. Like, I'm pretty, like, generally, like, I give it, like, 4 3/4. I think it's one of the greatest straight-up tag matches I've ever seen.
Okay.
My point is, I generally find myself, and I find you're completely different than this.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I think the Rumble is going to be a bigger illustration of this, the Rumble match on this pay-per-view. I generally find myself, I don't allow the hype to influence me. I'm like, okay, a lot of people think this is good. It's probably going to be good. And usually for me, I fall in line with the conventional wisdom. But I think I'm the outlier in society, not you.
I think most people are like me.
I always hear, and it pisses me off, like in sports. Mm-hmm. I'm not, picking on you or anything.
Go ahead.
But no, like people with the Browns, the Cleveland Browns. Let's take it beyond wrestling.
Okay.
With these expectations. By the way, folks, we will get back to your Intercontinental title match at the 1993 Royal Rumble momentarily. So with these dumb expectations.
Yeah.
People with the Browns helmet.
Right.
People if they just hadn't hyped it so much, I wouldn't have got excited. No, you're an idiot fan for allowing yourself to get hyped into it. Like, you shouldn't, allow yourself to be like, I have to like this match.
Right.
Or LeBron James is another example.
Mm-hmm.
People, because he's called King James and people make comparisons to Michael Jordan and he's not as good as Michael Jordan, but he's better than almost every other basketball player that's ever played the game that's not named Michael Jordan. People are like, this LeBron James, he's not that great, or whatever. I just think people do such a poor job of managing their own expectations based on hype. It pisses me
off. Well, and that's the thing,
too. Now, that being said,
I think I'm like most people who, when I hear something's good, when I hear something's bad, it influences when I go in.
That's a bad mistake.
Well,
so anyway.
In this case, it helped me enjoy it more because
I had a low bar. So I've watched this match multiple times.
Okay.
I remember at first I didn't really care for it that much.
Mm-hmm.
And then I rewatched it a few years ago. Just unlike the last part where I could do all these from memory.
Okay.
I've rewatched, given all these a fresh watch, these all mid-90s right. ones. I just watched, and 3 3/4 seems right. I remember one time I watched and I was like, wow, this is really good. And I don't remember it being this good. So I just want to go off I was really interested to know because this is not a match that a lot of people ever talk about, mm-hmm. but it is Michaels and Jannetty, who are, you think that would be good. This was their first singles match after, the barbershop incident the year before.
Yeah.
Jannetty made
year.
The huge comeback in the Guns N' Roses t-shirt.
Yeah.
And it was a great angle. And we should talk about Sherry. This is why I was interested. I was wondering how you felt about the Sherry dynamic, because that's a big part of this match. Future Sean Marty matches where it's just two guys wrestling for the title, former partners, it's good matches. This had Sherry as a big part of it, and I thought it both helped and hurt. It helped in a sense that when it was established she was no longer with Sean, because she comes out in the neutral corner.
Right.
They still play the Sean entrance music that she's singing, but she slapped Sean. That drew a huge pop.
Right.
And so it was good there. But the finish sucked, I thought, of this match for such a good match. The finish blew, where she was just standing around. There was a lot of standing around and stuff. And to your initial point with the whole, this is what got Jannetty fired.
Right.
It is odd that they'd be upset with his performance in this match, because I thought it was just fine.
If that was him with a head full of blow, he must be the greatest worker of all time, because forget about what you hear about Flair going out and doing 60 minutes being hung over to the gills. Jannetty's performance in this match, if he was as impaired as everybody thinks, match was a miracle.
Yeah, they do stuff here. You see some stuff here, and look, this is not something that would have stood out on the 1994 Super J Cup.
Right.
But they did stuff here that you didn't see a lot in WWE.
Right.
I think there was some I think there was a planche in this. I should have written that down, but I think there was. But overall, though, I really like this. I always liked the dynamic between Michaels and Jannetty. It was such a memorable split.
Yes.
That because how famous that angle is,
mm-hmm.
when Michaels turns on Jannetty, it always allowed for, I think, any interaction those two had to be meaningful.
It did.
Brett Ramone. Your opinion?
Well, first and foremost, I'm going to go back to something that I said when we were doing part one of this about how, and I think I referenced it in the case of Randy Savage from 91 to 92, about how jarring it was. 91, biggest war criminal heel in the history of civilization. I'm watching the 92 one right after that, and he's this big baby face. And what happened over the 12 months made sense. He went through a complete loop that made sense. But it's jarring watching it back-to-back. Brett Razor, after watching the main events of the previous years, Hulk Hogan on top, whatever, Brett Razor in the main event, well, co-main event with the Rumble, but for the championship, you know what I mean in that way, for the WWF championship, it felt mid-card.
It did.
Just did. Because it kind of was, because they did Brett no favors in this, and a couple times that Brett's been on the show.
He was in an almost impossible situation. I mean,
following
Hogan was going to be, no one was going to succeed in that spot, really.
Right.
But Brett, he wasn't given any more, like, it's funny, I understand why Vince just got the idea, all right, I'm putting the title on Brett, and I want to do it right away so no one can convince me otherwise.
Right.
I get his thinking, but it didn't help Brett, really, because people weren't ready for Bret Hart as champion. And in this instance, this match, I don't think people were ready, bought Razor Ramon as a legitimate challenger. Still green. I know he'd gotten the push and the rub. He'd kind of hung out with Ric Flair. But honestly, if you wanted they would have been better served if they wanted a bigger title match. They would have been better served doing Bret Flair, but I know Bret was sick of working with Flair at this point, and Flair also had one foot out the door.
Yeah,
so they didn't want to do that, and Flair was actually leaving the company the next night.
They were so bereft of star power.
Yeah. So it's not that this is a bad match. It's like 3.25, I think.
Well, Razor's a guy that wasn't even in the company at that time in the previous year. He'd been in the company about 6 months.
Well, and I have no problem with that, going with somebody new and somebody. It's just that.
But when things are thin, that exposes that things are thin. Because you didn't have guys getting hot-shotted into the main event picture that quickly in the
80s. It didn't feel like,
that's the thing.
Your point is well taken, that this did not feel like a big-time title match.
And I thought, again,
is we all know, is what makes wrestling work, is having a big-time main event. And Bret Hart, Razor Ramon, it's not that it's bad, it's just it didn't feel big.
Well, and here's the thing, too. Two guys, we don't need to put over anymore because it's already been done, and we both believe it, how great Brett is in the ring. And Razor, for not quite a big man, but a quasi-big man, medium-sized man, as he would say later on.
He was a good worker. I mean, he's a famous guy. I mean, people know Scott Hall, Razor Ramon.
Well,
one of the biggest stars.
I'm talking about him as a worker, though, and a pretty good worker for a man of his size. I think most would agree, especially when he was sober.
Yeah.
They had better matches than this, but they didn't seem like they jibed. I mean,
you're gonna
rag on me for being moves guy and Mr. Indie Wrestling, but I mean, so much selling, the limb selling, the downtime, the whatever.
I thought I thought Brett looked good in this. I thought Ramon was very green still. That was the problem. Ramon, I feel like I'm at the Hall of Fame last year.
Yeah.
Scott Hall.
Yeah.
He got better after this.
Right.
It was clearly a case of, to me, that I said it before, I don't think anyone bought these Brett as the champ or Ramon as legit contender, and that was the problem. Therein lies the issue that, they were okay, but they just, Brett hadn't grown into the champion role yet, and Ramon, it's funny, I joked as a kid, I kind of thought he was going to go over because it's like, Razor Ramon, and he did, and he had been coming off that tag match that had seemingly gotten higher promotion going into Survivor Series.
It had a crap finish, but now we know why, because they didn't want him to be tainted by a pinfall loss. Flair could have eaten the pinfall, probably should have, but still.
Yeah, that is true. I always forgot that.
That finish was horrible.
It was, because it's a great match.
It was.
It's a really heated match.
It was.
I thought Brett did as good as he could here. It just wasn't. It just isn't memorable.
No, not at all. And I'll tell you, too, we laughed about this off air. Subsequently, one of the worst matches and setups, whatever, and one of the last random, I think, matches we ever had at WrestleMania was Razor Ramon, Bob Backlund that year. And it just always struck me, with that being in Vegas, I suppose the analog for that musically would have been Jerry Garcia against Pat Boone. I mean, has there ever been two more bigger chemical opposites in their life than Razor Ramon and Bob Backlund?
That was a disaster. We will talk about Bob Backlund in 1993.
By the way, is it a rib that the druggie went over? I always wondered about that. It was the right decision
is what it was.
Probably. Honestly,
there was also really no build. It didn't help. Like, they did this angle where Ramon had, like, attacked Owen.
Right.
But, like, it wasn't like an interesting angle. Like,
no, not at all.
I actually had forgotten that happened until they showed it on the show.
Yes.
Like, I was like, what did they even do to set this up? I remember there was something where Flair and Ramon circled Hart on, like, one of those interview segments.
Right.
I just couldn't remember. This is just a very forgettable title match.
That
brings us to the Rumble, Rick Morris.
Yep.
A Rumble that you and I, through text messaging over the last week, have been getting rather contentious about,
and
which
it's
is still interesting.
On a Facebook, actually.
Yes, which is contentious because I don't think you love it, but as a guy who seems to be going rather low with the star ratings on these Rumbles, this is one that avoids your scorn, apparently, which is shocking to me because I'll let it out now. There's your point. Here's my counterpoint. I think this is one of the worst Royal Rumbles ever.
I don't agree.
With only a couple, there's only a few, and like the real obvious exceptions being worse. Rick Morris, why do you think this Royal Rumble is remotely redeemable?
I give it 3 stars, which this is my second highest one so far.
That is
insane. 1992. The Rumble had gotten more star-studded every year from 88 to 92, although I have in my notes here, you could make an argument, did it progress from 90 to 91? They were about
the same.
I thought it regressed a little bit. It might have. You could go either way on that. But basically, and of course, I mean, 92, we remember it. That will always be. I can't ever see a way that that gets surpassed in terms of star power in a Rumble. You'll never beat 92. So 93 was going to recede, but I didn't think it receded as much as you did. This certainly was on a par with 88 or probably even 89.
89, the star power is bigger than
maybe
this.
Maybe 89, but
come
certainly
on.
Not 88. There was no Danny Davis, Killer Bees. 88 wasn't intended
to be a main event match.
It was just intended to be a match. But for as depleted as they were, I think we can overstate that because they would get more depleted later on.
See,
you know, you said off air, you didn't think much of.
I don't think there is star power here. I think that our definition of star power is a little different here.
Should
we go into it? Because I do have in my notes about the territorial guys.
And as you know, I was an aftermath reader. I looked at the entire landscape of wrestling, not just the WWE.
Well, I'm not saying I didn't, but here's the problem. While you may have reveled in these guys being in the ring together, some of these guys, and we'll go through the names, the crowd didn't, and they didn't mean, most of them didn't mean anything.
But to me, the exchanges
were
very...
Bob Backlund is a problem in this match, not a solution.
A bug, not a feature. I liked the exchanges, and Flair was sort of the glue for a lot of this. The Flair-Backlund exchanges, Flair and Jerry Lawler, Flair and Tenru, Flair and Hennig, which was about to cap off the big feud.
That was okay.
Side note on that, the one thing that was kind of jarring, I don't mean jarring in a bad way, but jarring as far as you were not used to this, their interaction in the match was being used to put over. They will have a Loser Leaves Town match tomorrow night on Monday Night Raw.
Yeah, Raw had literally just started at this point,
which,
by the way.
And that told you that we were in a different era, because short of Saturday night's main event, I cannot ever remember when there would have been a pay-per-view or anything like that when they would have said, tune into our show this week to watch this.
Remember
it was a build to the pay-per-views, and now it was the other way around.
Remember we talked about this in 89? There was when Ron Bass comes out bald.
Oh, yeah.
And they sort of skirt around the issue why he's bald.
Because it was taped, yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah. So, here's, okay. You. It's funny. Let's go back to that expectations thing.
Yeah. I had low expectations.
So,
for this.
Am I allowed to say this?
Go ahead.
Fuck it. I'm going to.
Go ahead.
not dropping the F-bomb. That's all I'm going to say here.
Okay.
I watched this a couple weeks ago and I got ripped beforehand. Okay.
All right.
I was sitting by myself. I don't know what Cammy was doing. She was out. And I was like, you know what I'm going to do? Now that I got the house to myself, I'm going to sit with a dog, get high, and watch the 1993 Royal Rumble. And I'd watched it multiple times before.
Okay.
More times than I probably should have in my previous years.
Okay.
And I've never liked this Rumble.
Same
truth
state
be told.
Every time, probably.
Well, probably not 93, but when I initially watched it, but yes, the last
couple. I don't make that assumption.
Yes, the last.
You're 13.
Yes, the last couple times, probably. Probably wasn't the first time I watched it baked. It may not be the last. But I remember never liking this Rumble, and so for me, here's the expect. I always remember not liking it, so there's that expectation thing again. So
right.
But I went in with an open mind. This was before you texted me, by the way.
Okay.
Which is important.
See, because I thought this was going to suck, and I was pleasantly surprised it didn't.
So I do, I said I wrote here in the notes, it is pretty incredible that in the same ring you had Ric Flair, Bob Backlund, Ted DiBiase, Jerry Lawler, Tenryu, and Kurt Hennig.
Yep.
That's pretty crazy. And I was like, and to your point, I was like, wow, the star power, given what those names mean in the history of wrestling,
yes,
is maybe a little greater than I give it credit for. But you know what, Rick Morris? And I was like, okay, the first third of this thing isn't as bad as I was like, maybe I'm wrong on this. Maybe we'll keep watching. I got to be honest with you. A lot of those names didn't mean what you think.
To that audience, I'll agree.
And that's the problem here. Bob Backlund is an atrocity in 1993 as a baby. Like, I don't know what they were thinking leaving him in this long.
Yeah.
It was not over at all. He, coming into the show, he'd been booed on all the house shows. You referenced that Ramon Backlund match at WrestleMania.
Yeah.
In a couple months. He gets booed there. DiBiase, Flair, here's the problem I have too. Flair was being phased out here.
Right.
Even by Heenan, who was all over him, obviously, and, you know, that was part of the whole gimmick in 92.
Right.
Heenan was kind of like, oh, yeah, Ric Flair, I'm supposed to still be tied to him. But he had already kind of tied himself to Luger.
Right.
Flair had one foot out the door here, and that hurt this.
Heenan was saying that I hope he doesn't lose the match, and he got emotional during the exchanges with Hennig.
Which I'll get to in a second, because
yeah.
That's a pod. But DiBiase was, you know, on the tail end here. Lawler had just come in, and I just don't think meant anything to this audience. Tenryu meant less. Hennig was the exception. Hennig was really over here.
Right.
He was really – he had just come back into the big baby face turn. The crowd really woke up for him and Flair. I'll say this, by the way.
Yeah.
You can laugh at it. You can call people mouth breathers. You can call mm-hmm. them dumb. You can say whatever you want.
Okay.
This match starts with Flair, Backlund, and DiBiase. That's pretty
it
big
is.
Time. I mean, if this is the 1983 Royal Rumble, holy crap.
Yeah.
But you know when the crowd wakes up for the first time in this match?
When?
When Brian Knobbs comes out at number four because Money, Inc. and the Nasty Boys are feuding. So say what you will, I'm telling you, this territory, I know it's cool if like you're a trivia aficionado, like, wow, when did you ever see these guys in the ring? But the problem is here, man, it didn't mean anything.
Here's the thing, though. As far as
outside of Hennig and Flair, it did not mean much. And I'll say this, Kurt Hennig, so after all these guys are out, Kurt Hennig went out way too early, and it's at that point this match begins to die a horrible death.
What you're proving with a lot of the stuff here is that these Royal Rumbles, I'm not sure anybody's ever made the point of comparison to an impressionist painting before, but, you know, it's kind of, you know, I go back to, you know, the Big Lebowski, yeah, well, that's just like your opinion, man. I thought that was cool that all
I'm saying that, and you're entitled to it.
Yeah.
You're entitled to it, but I'm saying,
I mean,
from
I'm not,
my perspective,
the
do you understand, like,
yeah.
Like, people always say, like, you need to understand, like, people need to understand, and I'm good at that, you know, with the, another thing I think is, when I'm an outlier,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, it's funny, you mentioned Jerry Garcia, I love Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
I have a Grateful Dead shirt on right now, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
All right. I don't stomp my feet and get upset when people aren't interested in listening to a 37-minute version of Dark Star.
Okay.
Okay? Like,
all right.
I love it and think it's cool, but
okay.
I also understand that's kind of a minority take.
Yeah.
And to me, you have to kind of be like, okay. And to me, like I said, I noted it's pretty impressive to have those guys in there. But at the same, do you see what I'm saying?
Well,
to me, and you're going to go crazy and pull your hair out, with the exception of Flair and Hennig, which did draw the reaction.
Yeah.
And I've said that like three times on the last 3 minutes. You could replace the other six guys with six Doink the Clowns, man, and it would not have helped or hurt this match one bit.
Well, the crowd wasn't obviously conditioned to realize that these guys were a big deal. And that's, listen, and I said this to you off air. I always had a problem with the thing here as a proud AfterMag reader in the 80s, getting my...
You're going to call other people mouth breathers.
Well, yeah, because I cared about other territories, even ones that I'd never seen. So it was a thing where it always bothered me that they wouldn't acknowledge other promotions. So in a sense, I give them credit. But here's the thing. By doing it when they did, it was a sign of weakness.
Because, sign of decline. What are we calling part two?
Yeah, it
the
is.
The down years.
It is. Because, you know, and this is a popular thing that people have to laugh at from the 93 Rumble. Monsoon with his tongue-in-cheek reference to Cologne as
Carlos
a youngster.
Cologne.
As a youngster.
Who came in later, right? He was
came in later. Yeah. And referred to as a Caribbean champion, which I have in my notes here. Is that the first time since the expansion in 84 that they ever referred to an outside title? That might have been. Oblique though it was, it might have been.
Yeah, and guess what? He didn't mean a hill of beans either.
And mere months before.
He was down there with Max Moon and Damian Demento.
Right. And it foreshadowed the Smoky Mountain Alliance later in the year when you would have the Smoky Mountain Tag Team title represented at SummerSlam,
They did a better job with that.
Well, and I, once again, I loved that, and I thought, boy, they should have been doing this all along. And then I also thought, boy, does this look like a sign of weakness, though, because to the mouth breather target core audience, it's a thing of like, Ma, what's this Smoky Mountain wrestling they're talking about
well,
here?
Well, it's wrestling the way you like it.
Well,
the way it used to be.
But
was my favorite theme for any wrestling show ever. Like, I just laugh. I'm like, I love you, Jim Cornette, but Jesus,
right.
I feel like I'm supposed to go over on a Saturday morning out with my grandpa and like eat grits while I'm watching this freaking program. And it was a good program.
Great stuff.
All right. We're in agreement that. It's a little surprising that you have all these guys who are big stars in the territories are in the first third. The first third is not my problem with this match.
Well, and let me make a concession to you on this.
Well, good. I like when you do that.
Here's the thing, and this is unavoidable, okay? Had I watched this at the time, which I didn't, I don't think
did
I would
have.
Did you
never watch this?
Here's the thing. I had for a number of years, you know, been able to avail myself of the old scrambled pay-per-views back at home, whatever. I don't even – so this one would have been a scrambled pay-per-view, if that. I don't think I caught it even that way.
You didn't run videos?
No, I wasn't really big on that. So here's the thing.
It wasn't hard. You know, all you had to do was go to a video store and just check the video.
Well, my thing was, well, I already knew what happened thanks to the After Mags, so what do I need to go seek it out now for? So I had a different mentality. Watched a lot more of the pay-per-view stuff in the surrounding time than I did. At the time, I wouldn't have liked this.
McMahon have more in common than political views, apparently. Whoa, no one will want to see this if they know the spoilers. That's wrong, by the way, people.
That's true. At the time, I don't think I would have liked this very much because my expectations were what we had just come off of, the glory years, this was the beginning of the decay. Here's the thing, though. And this is unavoidable. It's human nature. It's 2015. I'm watching this through 2015 eyes. I'm not watching this through 1993 eyes. Through 2015 eyes, I thought this Royal Rumble match was pretty cool because my expectations were low, because there was still some residual star power, guys I regarded as being part of star power. And here's the thing, too, as we get further into the match, you're going to crap on this. I'm not going to, because the execution was awesome. Even if the guy they had was wrong.
Oh, no.
The whole Giant Gonzalez Undertaker thing.
I thought we were going to fight more about the territorial thing. I think we did that too much via text.
Okay.
All right. I'm going at you here.
They set him up to be Grim Death, which you had to for an Undertaker opponent to get him to be taken seriously because he was so strong at the time.
All right.
It was the wrong guy. And by the way, Harvey Whippleman, first of all,
is a tool and was a crappy manager and was a bum.
Well, he didn't have the pipsqueak charisma of a Jimmy Hart or a Jim Cornette, and that was an awful name. Part of Jimmy Hart and Jim Cornette getting over is that they had a name that flowed off the tongue a little better than Harvey Whippleman. That sounded like a jobber manager name.
Which he was.
Well,
he was Big Bully Busick. Remember that? Of course you thought that was cool.
I was just thinking about that the other day. Whatever happened to that guy? There's like a Busick guy in the independent scene now, I think. And I was like, I wonder if he's any relation to Big Bully Busick. But
all right.
But no, listen, you have to admit the execution. You might not like Giant Gonzalez and the bodysuit and the fur and all that.
I don't.
The execution of this was awesome. That's how you build somebody to take on The Undertaker.
The problem was, though, again, It's funny. We're going to talk about this more in 94 with the diesel push.
Okay.
There is the conception of what is supposed to work, and then there is, well, did the conception work in practice?
Okay.
I yield to you that if you want to put over a monster heel, this is the way to do it.
Yeah.
The problem is, Giant Gonzalez sucked. He didn't get over at all.
Here's the
thing,
though.
And this killed this match dead.
But here's...
Henning, like, this reminded me of the modern Rumbles, mm-hmm. where there are these guys who, okay, you kind of understand they're probably not going to win, and the promotion's not totally behind them, but you want them to be in the match for a long time so you can cheer them. Kurt Henning was tossed way too early in this thing.
Probably.
And, no, he was. It's not probably. He was. It was ridiculous how short of a time he was in. And then, so it's like, okay, then all of a sudden then when he goes out, this thing's starting to suck. Then the Undertaker comes out, and you're like, okay, he can save this thing. And what do you know, a couple minutes later.
Why would you have thought that? He wasn't a great worker in 93.
Well, because he would have kept the match over, though. He was over.
You're right.
It doesn't matter
okay.
if he's a worker. He's over.
You're right.
People cheered. He was better than Damian Demento and Max Moon.
By the way, I have in my notes here, Damian Demento and IRS, by the rules previously announced, should have been disqualified from the Rumble because notwithstanding Giant Gonzalez being in there, didn't you have to be in before the next guy got buzzed into the ring?
Yeah, but they violated that, I think, ever since. Yeah, they did say that once, but.
They did. And well, Damian Demento and IRS were so scared of Giant Gonzalez, they stayed out of the ring. I caught
for their
that.
2 minutes. Okay,
yes.
Well, whatever.
Yes.
Well, and Bob Backlund, by the way, was the only other guy in it, and he was out of he got hurt, or I forgot what happened.
Yeah.
So this is when, to me, Henning's elimination's bad,
yeah.
And then this is the part where the match dies for me. Like, it goes from, okay, this is kind of a subpar Rumble or whatever, to, oh my God, this is really getting bad. After this segment, and let's set the stage in case people haven't seen this. Undertaker, Giant Gonzalez makes his debut here.
It's a who is this guy thing.
Oh, my God. This guy's got to be 8 feet tall.
8 feet tall.
Look, Giant Gonzalez is one of those guys, when you look at him first, it's like, holy crap. And it's like you can see why a promoter would fall in love with him.
Yeah.
But the problem is, as soon as he did anything, it's like, oh, my God, this is horrible.
See, but I don't think he
wrote a very
here.
Interesting story.
Okay.
Oh, no. To me, you could see. And again, maybe there's preconceived notions of
sure.
what he is. But I had already seen him suck really bad in
and
WCW.
I think that's key to it. If you just watch it, trying to put yourself in the moment, I thought it worked. We know afterwards he fell on his ass and he was horrible. In that moment, I thought it worked.
I don't think it did work that as much as you thought.
Okay.
I agree that by the playbook of getting over a monster heel, it was done the only way you could.
And they rarely have ever did this with Undertaker. Undertaker never... You can count on one hand the number of times Undertaker sold for a guy
and
like
this. And
this
kind of started a really horrible period for him of guys that he was working with. Well, he did sort of something with Kamala a little
bit.
Yeah,
he was already in the dregs of the company phase for opponents.
But anyway, I thought this killed him. And he destroys the Undertaker and throws him out. And I thought it was so groan-worthy. I thought the way Gonzalez moved, it was embarrassing. And it basically left the match with Demento, IRS, and Backlund, like we said.
Yeah.
And from that point out, man, the second half of this Rumble is as bad as any half of any Rumble ever.
I disagree with that because I thought it was pretty cool where you had the showdown spot later on. We talked about Yokozuna. You get the showdown spot with him and Earthquake.
That was a minor thing, but that's bad. That's grasping at straws.
I don't know.
Here's the problem. Yokozuna, let's go all the way back to what I said when we started this thing, those many minutes ago. There was a huge sense of inevitability going into this show. I remember this way
maybe
back
among
when.
The sheet readers, but I don't remember it being that obvious.
Oh, they were really promoting Yokozuna. They're like, who's going to throw him out? And you're thinking, you're like, who
Here's
it is?
Here's a funny thing. They always say that, and it almost never comes true because 20 guys get together and throw the guy out.
And
this is one of the only times.
They didn't do it. But here's the thing. Not only did he win, he came in so late that it was so obvious at that point because there wasn't, like, you didn't ever have that where all the guys teamed up, and he could have fought it off. He just came in and just destroyed the morass that was in there at the time, and it comes down to him and Randy Savage, who was being phased out of the card. Savage does, you know, another infamous moment in this Rumble is the whole thing with – him attempting to pin Yokozuna at the end and then getting that's how he gets thrown over the ropes.
Shades of Valentine Garvin. I will say, I thought that was one of the worst big eliminations I'd ever seen. It was so obvious he was leaping off the canvas to get over the top.
The only thing I have written down here that was remotely woke this crowd up in the second half of the Rumble was Santana and Martel going at it for old time's
sake. I disagree. Savage popped the crowd, I believe.
Savage actually had crowd before Stupidity. He did because I think people were desperate to not see Yokozuna win. It was a role that I think a lot of bait would have worked for baby faces.
Yeah.
And Savage is better, obviously. He's a bigger star. But I just think overall, man, the second half of this Rumble sucks so bad. I give it 2 stars, and there are only 3 Rumbles that we will ever talk about that are worse.
I disagree. I clearly disagree.
Here's
the thing, too, and with Savage.
One of them is during this time period, by the way.
One of the things that I bitch about is that you didn't have the previous big time guys from the generation putting over the guys from this generation. And granted, being one of the last 2 guys in the Rumble and losing the Rumble to the other guy is not exactly the same as doing a job. But Savage gave more of a rub to Yokozuna than just about any other star from the previous generation gave to the new generation. I give them credit for that.
He was kind of made to look pretty inferior here.
Yes.
But overall, I am so bored by this. I thought this was such a boring Rumble. And that's the problem. The Rumble is generally not boring, is my
problem. No, it's not.
So to me, this is the most boring, and there aren't many worse than this. For me, it's funny. You call this, so you said this is your second highest rated.
Second highest rated so far. 3 stars in there. And spoiler alert, there are none other from the 90s that are higher. Or I'm sorry, 93 to 97. This is my highest rated of
those.
This is.
Of the Rumbles we've covered so far, excluding 88, which is harder to rate because it's not the same match. This is my lowest rated Rumble so far, 2 stars.
Wow.
Lowest rated.
I have to say this, and I have come around to the whole thing here. People are always looking for the dividing line of mankind, whether it's red state, blue state, whatever, and certainly you and I are on opposite divides there. The real separator to me with human nature, people who really like the 93 Rumble versus people who really like the 94 Rumble, I am convinced of that. You and I are. This is the defining issue of mankind,
I think.
What's
funny, though, is, all right, this is a spoiler alert to the next part. It's not that I love the 94 Rumble. I definitely think it's better than 93. And
you really like it, though.
Not really.
I mean,
it's not better than average. Well, I like it the best of the five in this part, and I'll get into why in our next part.
Well, that in and of itself is amazing.
Well, the people are going to have to click on another little FDH Lounge mini episode to find out why I like that. I'm not giving them that information here.
Right. We'll get to that. Each one of these in their own time. But I will say this. We'll bring it around on this note here. And that,
what are you doing?
I asked somebody to be the tiebreaker for 93 and 94.
Well, I didn't approve of this person as a tiebreaker, whoever he was.
Well, you don't even know who I'm going to say specifically. But fellow member of the 21st Century Media Alliance from the Unheard Scene, Anthony Patrone.
Oh, boy.
I asked him about this. Anthony, admittedly, somebody who doesn't watch a lot of wrestling. But,
okay, so, I mean, there's nothing better than asking someone like that
to
be a tiebreaker for...
So I asked him about that. What do you think? He goes, which year... was The Undertaker in the Rumble? I said 93. 94, he was in the title match. Okay, then I'll take 93. And I have just captured for posterity your face.
Now, is this picture going to go up as the thumbnail
for this episode? Wouldn't that be great if it did?
You should do that, otherwise people aren't going to know what you just did. You have to put the picture up as the thumbnail now as you take a picture of my disgusted face. It's the stupidest fucking viewpoint I've ever heard in my life.
He said it, Anthony.
Mouth breathers. And that's the guy you're going to lean on.
He said
Good
it, Anthony.
Lord, get
me.
Out of here. Let's move on to 1994. Right. End this mini episode. I can't believe we talked this long about this show.
On that note, here we go. Goodbye, folks.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.